in April 1842. That he delivered his performance so often and effectively is due to its humor, to its constant use of parallelism and antithesis, and to its resonance in Christian New England. Garrisonianism was above all a religious social crusade against the conscience and sloth of the faithful. But the sermon was also funny, and its author could alter the tone, scene, or length to fit the occasion. Douglas often began by reciting the story of the Reverend Isaac Bonney in New Bedford, separating blacks from whites for communion. But one Sunday, Bonney blundered. After a baptism in which several white and one black woman had been anointed in the same water, the communion cup was passed. A foolish, abolitionist-leaning deacon saw the black woman step in line between the whites, so he handed her the cup. But when the precious blood which had been shed for all reached the next white woman, she rose in disdain and walked out of the church. Brimming for the sarcastic kill, the orator did not stop there. Another young lady fell into a trance, barked Douglas. When she awoke, she declared she had been to heaven. Her friends were all anxious to know what and whom she had seen there. One good old lady especially needed to know if she saw any black folks in heaven. Then came the punchline. Oh, I didn't go in the kitchen. Douglas paced to another position on the platform, awaiting the howling laughter to subside. Rooted in memories of watching Thomas Auld weep during his confessions in the ring at the Methodist camp meeting on the Eastern Shore, in Edward Covey's prayer sessions, and in his New Bedford preaching experience, Douglas saved his best for the Christian hypocrisy of the South. If he spoke in a church or hall with a gallery, he made special use of the setting, as he did in 1842 at Faneuil Hall in Boston. Peering up into the horseshoe balcony of that great arena before 4,000 people and spreading his arms out widely, he appealed as though to the slaves set apart in the gallery of a Southern church. With a mocking Southern accent, he called out, "And you too, my friends, have souls of infinite value. Souls that will live through endless happiness or misery in eternity. Oh, labor diligently to make your calling and election sure. Oh, receive into your souls these words of the holy apostle. Servants, be obedient to your masters." Amid shouts of laughter and applause, Douglas pranced on the stage and drove his point home. Oh, consider the wonderful goodness of God. Look at your hard, horny hands, your strong, muscular frames, and see how mercifully he has adapted you to the duties you are to fulfill. While to your masters, who have slender frames and long, delicate fingers, he has given brilliant intellects that they may do the thinking, while you do the working. Douglas eventually boiled down these tales into a compelling assertion of contrasts that he used throughout the 1840s. By 1845, he could rip it off at a moment's notice, often right after reciting the Golden Rule. In America, Bibles and slaveholders go hand in hand. The church and the slave prison stand together, and while you hear the chanting of psalms in one, you hear the clanking of chains in the other. The man who wields the cowhide during the week fills the pulpit on Sunday. The man who whipped me in the week used to show me the way of life on the Sabbath. A star had been born. A youthful, brilliant black voice of a fugitive slave had entered the fray of abolitionism. At a mere 24 years old, Douglas stepped out now on countless platforms to preach a Garrisonian ideological mixture of radicalism and personal testimony. Soon, he carried abolitionist fervor and rhetoric, as well as the Frederick Douglass story, across the northern states in a crusade he increasingly made his own. Chapter 8. Garrisonian in Mind and Body. These hands, are they not mine? This body, is it not mine? I am your brother, white as you are. I'm your blood kin, You don't get rid of me so easily. If I go to Lexington or Bunker Hill, there I'm a slave, chained in perpetual servitude. I may go to your deepest valley, to your highest mountain. I'm still a slave, and the bloodhound may chase me down. Frederick Douglass, an address in New York City, March 6, 1845. From 1842 to 1845, Douglass took his flourishing mind, his increasingly confident voice, and his Garrisonian body to the open road. His travel and speaking itineraries almost defy belief, and his devotion to Garrisonian ideology remained steadfast. From late March to early May 1842, he did an intensive tour of eastern and central Massachusetts. On this, his first solo tour, he spoke in at least 42 different towns or small villages, often visiting two towns in a single day and lecturing twice in the same place in a single day. Immediately upon ending the Massachusetts tour, Douglass caught the train for New York, where he participated along with 3,000 fellow abolitionists in the annual meeting of the American Anti-Slavery Society, AASS, at the Broadway Tabernacle. At this New York meeting, he likely first met James McCune Smith, a physician and intellectual, and the most educated African American in the United States. Their relationship would be long and enduring, although it would take time to develop. The young fugitive slave and gifted orator, soon to be a sterling writer without a day of formal schooling, and the New York-born man of learning with 3 advanced degrees from the University of Glasgow in Scotland, would become, within a decade, an extraordinary story of creative alter egos. No record survives of their first conversations, but they did speak up for the same resolution supporting an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, testing whether blacks possessed the privileges and immunities of citizens. In the early 1840s, as abolitionism underwent the bitter schisms between moral suasionists and the advocates of political action, Smith remained ideologically a partial Garrisonian, a member of the AASS, but one who chose his allegiances pragmatically. Only 5 years older than Douglass, Smith was born a slave, but freed in the 1827 New York Emancipation Law. He had a thriving medical practice in Lower Manhattan by the 1840s, and already flourished as an essayist on many subjects. He was never the itinerant lecturer that his younger friend became. Douglass, however, took to the anti-slavery circuit constantly, performing as a loyal disciple of his mentor. For a week in June 1842, Douglass toured for the first time with Garrison as they barnstormed through meetings in 6 towns on Cape Cod. This tour also included George Bradburn, a Unitarian minister from Attleboro, Massachusetts, who never fully embraced Garrisonianism, but was a frequent companion of Douglass's on the circuit. Bradburn never adhered to the doctrine of anti-politics, since he was a Whig Party representative from Nantucket in the Massachusetts legislature. The primary theme of the Cape Cod tour was non-resistance, the strict adherence to pacifism that Garrison advanced. Anti-slavery meetings that trumpeted non-resistance gave Garrison yet another opportunity to use Douglass, as Garrison also vigorously promoted Douglass's career. After Garrison spoke at length in support of moral suasion and non-resistance at the Barnstable meeting, Douglass took the platform and did his job with apparent fervor. Garrison's description of Douglass's speech is a stunning example of the mentor's unending effort to employ every element of the former slave's persona, his words, his very body, in the service of the cause. "Douglass stood there as a slave," announced Garrison. "A runaway from the southern house of bondage, not safe for even 1 hour, even on the soil of Massachusetts, with his back all horribly scarred by the lash." One cannot help wondering, in these years when the two men became close associates, and with Garrison so often referring to Douglass's physical scars, whether the young star orator ever actually showed his naked back to his mentor. Whether he did so or not, Garrison claimed Douglass had every right to be the fierce outlaw and the stern avenger. Instead, Garrison pointed to his prime exhibit as the genius of Christianity. That Douglas could rise on such occasions not to advocate retaliation, nor to wade through blood to liberty, no matter how justified, but to preach with forgiveness in his heart, made him a model for the potential overthrow of every form of oppression on earth. One wonders how much the youthful Douglas, inspired and proud to be on platforms next to Garrison, really believed in such utopian sensibilities. Not forever could his personal rage against slavery be contained in a pacifist ideological package. At one of the Cape Cod meetings, the three abolitionists spoke to a resolution, resolved that a Christian cannot fight with weapons against his enemies or the enemies of others, nor take the life of his fellow man, nor assist or empower others to take it, either in self-defense or as a penalty for crime. Douglas had many times violated this maxim during his life as a slave. For now, he was all but swallowed up in an anti-slavery theology, and he managed to preach its creeds with anyone, as long as he was free to tell his own story, to pillory the pro-slavery clergy, and begin to expose Northern racism in his own style. In his portrayals of Douglas, Garrison could be exultant in one sentence and condescending in the next. When Douglas spoke in support of the non-resistance resolution, Garrison saw the power of an unsophisticated mind and the glow of an earnest heart. Douglas's words left a visible impression on the audience. In other words, Garrison got everything he wanted from his star pupil. At yet another Cape Cod stop, Centerville, Garrison said Douglas spoke experimentally in unmasking the abominable hypocrisy of Southern religion. Here, Garrison found his own awkward way to praise Douglas's emerging craft of mimicry. Perhaps white leader and black follower both rolled their eyes about each other in private. As an observer in North Dennis remarked, the young black man gave us a good proof of the freedom of his mind, his wit, and power of sarcasm. He was at once Garrison's experiment and his own emerging self-invention. Amid all the moral earnestness of an abolitionist meeting, Douglas had learned how to leave them laughing. At the Hyannis meeting on June 20th in a Baptist church, Douglas experimented in yet another way. Giving testimony of what his own eyes had seen, he read a large amount of evidence given by Southern men, proving the entire slave system to be diabolical. Here, Douglas likely read detailed descriptions from Theodore Weld's American Slavery as It Is, a technique he would use frequently in the 1840s. Published in 1839, Weld's Moral Suasionist Classic, an unprecedented compilation of the horrors of slave treatment and punishment drawn from travelers' accounts, newspapers, and slaveholders' own writings, was a storehouse of slavery's inhumanity. Douglas would often read at length a litany of statements about the numbers of lashes applied to slaves for certain offenses, and the physical brutalities and scars left on slaves' bodies, as reported in runaway advertisements. What a compelling scene it must have been for an audience listening to Douglas in his pounding baritone, referencing his own scars, then performing from Weld's lists of mutilations, burnings, shootings, and images of ears cut off, hands cut with an axe, chains around a slave's neck, and the like. Douglas found his own ways to make moral suasion penetrate the heart by more than mere assertion. He learned how to leave them weeping. In the early 1840s, Garrisonian abolitionists caused a violent response around New England and the Northeast. Douglas continued his backbreaking travel in the late summer of 1842, returning to abolitionist conventions in New Bedford and on Nantucket on the first anniversary of his original public appearance. Anti-abolition mobs attacked both gatherings. In New Bedford, the mob seems to have been content with shouting down the speakers. But on Nantucket, on August 11th, ruffians disrupted the gathering, with Garrison, Collins, Douglas, and Stephen Foster all on the platform by hooting, screeching, throwing brickbats and other missiles through windows. On the following day, trying again to assemble, the meeting heard Douglas attack racism in the North as the cause of exciting mobs against the colored people, preventing them from taking their places in society as equal members. And the mob was ready to enact their part of this dangerous ritual. This time, the mob's numbers and weapons, including a shower of rotten eggs, were such that the meeting finally adjourned in chaos. In one full year on the anti-slavery circuit, Douglas had now collected many such badges of honor, well-publicized instances of being thrown off rail cars, bricks hurled at his head, hooligans shouting "nigger," and bringing greater attention to abolitionist ideas as well as free speech. Even clearer now was that for a 24-year-old black man with growing fame and an astonishing new voice, abolitionism was a dangerous business. But in this romantic age, the radical reformer who did not trouble the waters and stir the ire of his foes might be ignored. Ideas, spiritual passion, personal witness, and brazen effrontery were all part of the tactical repertoire. A fast learner, Douglas threw himself avidly into this fray, even as he traveled with a Garrisonian ideological cloak. During a mere week's respite at home in Lynn in August, Douglas spoke at a large non-resistance meeting at the Lyceum Hall. Growing in confidence and boldness, he spoke about the nature of prayer. As reported by Nathaniel Rogers, Douglas argued that the most effectual sort of prayer was doing and not saying. In what likely seemed the voice of an angry young man to his Christian neighbors, he said his prayers in words had never been answered as a slave. Only his own action, by running away to freedom, achieved a prayer answered. Rogers found Douglas especially eloquent and powerful. No brickbats flew in Lynn. Douglas had hardly been home at all during that first full summer on the circuit. Now, sponsored by Garrison's office in Boston, and after hasty hellos and goodbyes to Anna and the three small children, he headed out on a 2-month crusade through New York State with 7 other agents employed by the AASS, including Abby Kelly, the female sensation of the movement. 7 years older than Douglas, Kelly was born to a Quaker farm family in the rural hills of western Massachusetts, worked as a school teacher in Lynn, and eventually lived near Worcester. By 1840, she had emerged as one of the most tireless and militant speakers among the Garrisonians. Kelly was pretty, wore plain gray dresses, and at least in these early years, skillfully argued the moral suasionist case against slavery and for women's equality. She bought in fully to Garrison's form of perfectionism, was a staunch non-resistant, and for now denounced political parties. Soon, she would marry Stephen Foster, an abolitionist from New Hampshire, and they would form a radical married couple like few others. She was sharp-tongued and as adept as any of her male counterparts at abolitionist factional infighting. She wowed audiences even as they detested her very presence in public forums as a woman. Many a church sanctuary or town hall was closed to the troupe because of her leading role in anti-slavery tours, but they pressed on nonetheless, holding meetings in groves, meadows, and on town greens. Douglas was at first awed by Kelly, and understood that he was the second billing on this grueling New York crusade, much of which Kelly had planned in concert with Collins, the physician Erasmus D. Hudson, and the AASS Executive Committee, as a grand effort to revitalize local anti-slavery societies. In a promotional letter detailing the dates of conventions in 24 counties, Collins touted Kelly and Douglas as the headliners, declaring it well worth a journey of 40 miles to listen to the eloquent pleadings of Frederick Douglass, the fugitive from our peculiar institutions. Garrison eventually dubbed Kelly the moral Joan of Arc of the world, and Douglas so young and inexperienced with ideas about women's equality and with learned women, likely gained his first feminist education from the Quaker woman whom he watched facing all manner of vicious repression. He was part of something new, an angry, radical, beloved community, a salvation show traveling through the burned-over district. Douglas joined Kelly, Hudson, Collins, and others in Rochester on August 26th, more than 2 weeks into the tour. Hudson was an especially passionate, doctrinaire Garrisonian who kept a remarkable journal along the way. On this first visit to his future home, Douglas found Rochester hospitable. On the second night of the meetings, Douglas joined other abolitionists at the home of Amy and Isaac Post, local Quaker abolitionists. Their meeting was the beginning of a long and abiding friendship. The abolitionists tried to convene meetings at a Presbyterian church, only to have the minister throw them out due to Kelly's presence. Gathering in yet a different church, Collins and Hudson were verbally attacked by a heckler for their claims against religious hypocrisy. Rising to defend his colleagues, Douglas, reported Hudson, chastised the assailant by using Christ's warnings to scribes, Pharisees, and hypocrites, vipers, lawyers, whited sepulchres, and making congregational prayers. Douglas would have drawn from Matthew, Isaiah, or other parts of God's denunciations of the appearances of the good, ye blind guides, among those who do evil. Furious over church doors slammed in abolitionists' faces, Douglas commanded everyone's attention with such biblical ridicule as, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye are like unto whited sepulchres, which indeed appear beautiful outward, but are within full of dead men's bones." Ever ready with God's voice from the King James text when he needed it, one imagines Douglas rebuking the heckler, Bible in hand. Holding meetings in some 19 towns, the intrepid abolitionist band trekked on, staying wherever they could find friendly accommodations. They traveled in farm wagons, in carriages, and commercial stagecoaches, on the Erie Canal, and where possible, on railroads. In the decade or so after the completion of the Erie Canal in 1825, the new commercial waterway connecting western New York, and therefore the Midwest, with the port of New York, frontier settlements along the route transformed into the thriving market and manufacturing towns of Albany, Utica, Syracuse, Rochester, and Buffalo. From 1820 to 1850, Rochester alone grew from a population of 1,502 to 36,403. Waves of religious revivalists, spiritualists, utopian socialists, millers, small-scale merchants, as well as droves of hard-drinking, tobacco-chewing immigrant laborers settled in these booming cities. Abolitionists, such as the Kelly Douglas Band of 1842 across New York, sought to harness the anxieties and hopes of this emerging middle class undergoing social and economic transformations. Radical abolitionists were a religious and political threat to this new social order. Their task was far from simple. Some towns turned out large audiences, but in others, they were met with shuttered church buildings or violently hostile mobs. At Vienna, Hudson recorded, "A mob pelted the speakers with a shower of brickbats and stones and threw a little pig up into our hall." With the meeting broken up, the abolitionists retreated to the railroad depot. At Port Byron, Kelly spoke to an overflow crowd of 400 at the National Hotel amid continual hissing and murmuring. When the Baptist meeting house in Ithaca threw the band of lecturers out of its evening session, they adjourned into God's house, the open air, and held their impromptu meeting in the courthouse square. Some in the mob eventually climbed to the tower and rang the courthouse bell to break up the meeting. Sometimes, when they could not secure a venue, they held an anti-slavery meeting in a tavern, as they did in late September in Trumansburg on Cayuga Lake. Itinerant anti-slavery activism was a lonely, dangerous, and frustrating vacation. As Hudson put it, they were out to morally assault the conscience of every community, so many of which they found full of slavery, war, and all evil. Rejection became their badge of honor, one brickbat and epithet at a time. They were the suffering servants in Isaiah, and happy to remind all who would listen, he is despised and rejected of men. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities, and with his stripes we are healed. By the early 1840s, a decade of major railroad expansion, the New York Central Railway was completed along most of the route of the Erie Canal. Yet many of the towns and villages on the 1842 AASS tour, as well as countless more to follow in the coming years for Douglas, were not on railroad lines. Abolitionists were masters of the new technologies of printing and mass dissemination of newspapers and information, as well as eager adherents of the transportation revolution of the era. But for a troop of 4 to 8 anti-slavery lecturers, one of them a courageous, independent, unmarried woman, travel was a saga of daily hardship as well as adventure. Broken braces underneath a stagecoach led to countless accidents and injuries. Famous English travelers such as Charles Dickens and Harriet Martineau left compelling and witty remembrances of their experiences on American railroads, canals, and in stagecoaches. From his journeys through New England and out to Ohio and the upper Mississippi Valley in 1842, Dickens made unforgettable observations about the travails of stagecoach travel. He rode the entire south-to-north length of Ohio in both the large 12-seat mail coach and a 4-horse, 4-passenger, extra stage that in some areas one could rent exclusively. Corduroy roads, made by throwing tree trunks into a marsh, nearly dislocated all the bones in the human body, wrote Dickens. On an especially bad road, on a stormy night, the passengers at one point were all flung together in a heap at the bottom of the coach, and at another, we were crushing our heads against the roof. Dickens saved most of his sarcasm for the dirty, sullen, and taciturn coachman, who spoke only in monosyllables and cared far more for his horses than his passengers. Martineau and Dickens were both enthralled by the railroads and by the beauty and scale of American landscapes. Martineau, however, found American traveling manners anything but amiable, but she was entranced with the engineering achievement of the Erie Canal during her mid-1830s journeys, and she thought railroads a revolution without end for America. Like Alexis de Tocqueville just before her, Martineau left an indelible impression of a society constantly on the move, advancing the communication and transportation revolutions. All this she gushed over before writing the longest chapter of her Society in America, Morals of Slavery, a penetrating, compassionate, but outraged examination of slavery's threat to all that America promised. Dickens, too, stopped to observe that, as a black man never travels with a white one, there is also a Negro car, which is a great, blundering, clumsy chest, such as Gulliver put to sea in, from the kingdom of Brobdingnag. In such conveyances, under such conditions, day in and day out, Douglas, Kelly, and their companions spread the anti-slavery gospel across the hills and dales of the northern landscapes, at 4 miles per hour on canals, 6 to 8 on stagecoaches, and perhaps 20 or 30 on the iron horse. Since most of them were teetotalers, at least they did not have to share Dickens's disgust at being forced to drink bad tea and coffee at a temperance hotel, where a glass of brandy was not to be had for love or money. The New York tour ended in Cooperstown on October 25th, and as the company disbanded, Douglas returned to Lynn. But he was quickly caught up in the cause celebre of a fugitive slave named George Latimer, a case that would preoccupy New England abolitionism for many months to come. Douglas could not have been home with his family more than 3 days when he hurried to Boston to speak to a crowd of 4,000 people on a subject dear to his heart. The streets of Boston swarmed with competing crowds, either resisting or supporting the arrest of Latimer on October 19th. Early that month, Latimer, a light-skinned slave from Norfolk, Virginia, and his pregnant wife, Rebecca, had fled aboard a ship to Boston. Because he had long worked around the maritime businesses of Norfolk and passed for white, he bought passage for two, and his wife traveled as a servant. Within their first week in Boston, they were identified by a James Gray, a former employee of Latimer's owner in Virginia. Gray's slave catcher agents had George arrested. Quickly, the news spread to the black community on Beacon Hill in Boston, and anti-slavery friends secretly hid Rebecca. As a crowd of at least 300, mostly black protesters, kept up a tense and loud vigil outside the jailhouse for several nights, demanding Latimer's release under a writ of habeas corpus, Massachusetts Chief Justice Lemuel Shaw ruled that Gray had a right to retrieve the jailed man under the federal fugitive slave law of 1793. As abolitionist lawyers obtained a continuance for Latimer, he was kept in jail under an agreement between Gray and the jailer. But as the captor and jailer became unnerved at the increasingly aggressive abolitionist protests, Gray, rather than allow police to take Latimer back and forth to the courthouse for his trial, offered to sell the fugitive, first for $800, then settling under pressure for $400 in late November. Latimer was freed to abolitionist Boston's jubilation, but not before a wave of rowdy Latimer meetings and rallies spread across New England. A new journal was founded in his name, and a massive petition drive began demanding repeal of the federal fugitive slave law. At a Faneuil Hall meeting, a crowd packed to the rafters became so noisy and disruptive that the speakers, including Garrison, Wendell Phillips, Charles Lennox Raymond, and Douglas, could hardly be heard. Despite the turmoil, Douglas, according to press reports, shouted and gesticulated for about 20 minutes and tried to tell them he was a slave, and what were his fears for himself and hundreds of his brethren. With the northern freeborn African-American Raymond as companion, Douglas then took to the road for many days using the Latimer crisis to spread the anti-slavery word until his voice gave out and he fell sick. At home in Lynn, allowing Anna to nurse his ailing throat, Douglas wrote his first of many public letters to Garrison and thereby to the Liberator's readers. In quite formal language, Douglas reported as a good disciple about the New Bedford Latimer meetings. He described large crowds that needed no bells to remind them of their duty to bleeding humanity. Under the urgency of the Latimer fugitive case, Douglas reported the Garrisonian machine in well-oiled form. Not a word was lost. It was good seed sown in good ground by a careful hand. It must, it will bring forth fruit. He spoke an hour himself on the question as to whether a man is better than a sheep, then sat down, seized with a violent pain in his chest and shortness of breath. That winter and into the spring of 1843, Douglas celebrated the 65,000 signatures on the monster petition delivered to the Massachusetts legislature and applauded the personal liberty law passed in March that forbade state officers from participating in the arrest of fugitive slaves. On a few occasions, he appeared with Latimer himself, with Douglas doing most of the speaking about the plight of fugitives. As he turned 25 years old, Douglas now knew his calling, and something of the physical, personal, and intellectual demands of working in the ideological world of the Garrison Church. Into the spring and summer of 1843, Douglas rarely escaped the speaking circuit of Massachusetts and Rhode Island for more than 1 week at a time. One can only guess at how Anna coped, binding shoes and nursing children in Lynn. How many sharp-tongued rebukes did she give her husband, or were they simply long sighs, as he told her a day or so after arriving at home that he would be in Worcester or Providence or some other town for the next several days? Or did he tell her the itineraries at all? One might imagine that Anna lived vicariously through the travels of her peripatetic, increasingly famous husband. but she might just as likely have been too worried about a child's winter cough or taking in a neighbor's washing for extra money to wish to know where all those countless towns existed on a map. Certainly, she worried about Frederick's safety and health out on the road, facing anti-abolition mobs. By any measure, the Garrisonians were uncompromising in their goals and tactics. Theirs was a biblically driven approach to the social and personal sin of slaveholding. Slavery in America was a national sin with many complicitous institutions, none more so than churches and the clergy, but also political parties and governments themselves at both state and federal levels. In his 1843 tours, Douglas spoke in favor of one resolution after another, advocating the dissolution of the Union and against political action as corrupt and inadequate. He supported abolitionists' disruption of church worship services to condemn ministers and congregants to their faces, while saving most of his energy for his popular slaveholders' sermon performances. Eventually, their quest for purity of motive and strategy would drive the Garrisonians into a self-destructive isolation. Neither uncertainty nor ambivalence troubled this band of holy warriors, and Douglas appeared for now as one of their firmest voices. He proposed resolutions of his own, such as the one he announced at a Worcester County Anti-Slavery Society gathering on February 2nd. Resolved that the hands of the American church are full of blood, and that she is not, while she continues thus, what she assumes to be, the heaven-appointed instrumentality for reforming the world. Douglas disturbed, as he also inspired, audiences, accusing pro-slavery churches of refusing to see the pit of slavery they helped create. On their way to the mountain to discuss some new topic, he declared, "Ministers and their deacons spread over this pit the priest's pontifical robe." He performed this part of the Garrisonian repertoire better than anyone else. But Douglas also played in season and out in his most expected role, as personal witness to the slaves' trauma. In March 1843, Anne Weston wrote to her sister Maria, who ran Garrison's headquarters in Boston, telling of seeing Douglas speak to a full house and feeling somewhat disappointed that he dwelled on his slave past. He was more in the narrative and familiar vein and kept the audience laughing all the time. He was eloquent occasionally, but as he was telling his own experience, there was not so much chance for flowers of rhetoric as might be. Such were now the burdens of expectation on the young abolitionist's shoulders, even among his friends. At a meeting in Lowell, Massachusetts, in April, appearing again with Latimer, Douglas made a typical pronouncement. "I am one of the things of the South." Drawing himself up to his full height and spreading his arms wide, wrote an observer, Douglas declared, "Behold the thing." With such performances, wrote his auditors, Douglas could move the audience at will. They would hang upon his lips with staring eyes and open mouths. Still tethered to the organization's ideological prescriptions, Douglas nevertheless made his mind and body into a story that his thousands of listeners would never forget. Douglas spoke at the 10th annual meeting of the AASS in New York City, and then at a raucous, mob-disrupted gathering in Hartford, Connecticut, in the second and third weeks of May, 1843. At the Hartford meeting, Douglas was taunted with shouts of "nigger," and with several abolitionist comrades, was thrown out of a hall, pelted with stones and eggs, and forced to speak on a makeshift box on the street, where the group made the right of free speech as much their subject as moral suasion. Douglas then retreated to Lynn for a respite and to prepare for the biggest tour the Garrisonians had ever mounted, the 100 Conventions campaign throughout the remainder of 1843. From July to December, the Board of Managers of the AASS sponsored an ambitious tour, projected to be 100 meetings in at least 5 northern states, Vermont, New York, Ohio, Indiana, Pennsylvania, and with a goal of spreading the truth before from 300,000 to 500,000 people. The six primary lecturers were Douglas, George Bradburn, Charles Lennox Raymond, James Monroe, John Collins, and Jacob Ferris. Occasionally they would be joined by Abby Kelly, William A. White of Massachusetts, and Sidney Howard Gay of New York City. The troops of speakers were to live off the land, so to speak, relying on abolitionist friends in every city or rural town. In the weeks before the first official convention in Middlebury, Vermont, Douglas threw himself into fundraising meetings in New Hampshire and Massachusetts. As he later remembered, he never entered upon any work with more heart and hope. It would take a great deal of both, as well as sheer stamina and physical courage, to survive. By now, Douglas knew how tumultuous abolitionist meetings and personalities could be. In June, he wrote to Abby Kelly describing a meeting he had just attended in Concord, New Hampshire, as disgraceful, alarming, divided, united, glorious, and most effective. In the coming tour, he would need deep reserves of this sense of wit and irony. As a broad movement, abolitionists were not united. Embroiled now in a bitter rivalry with the emerging abolitionist Liberty Party, founded in part by the writer and activist Alvin Stewart of upstate New York, the Garrisonians attacked the political abolitionists as they were also confronted and pilloried by them nearly everywhere they went. Libertyites urged their followers to either boycott or disrupt the 100 Conventions campaign. In the college town of Middlebury, Vermont, students, Douglas said, placarded the town with violent aspersions against the lecturers, accusing Douglas of being an escaped convict from the state prison. Bracing for such hostility, the activists headed into New York State, and after a poorly attended meeting in Utica, they moved on to Syracuse, where Douglas in particular ignited some useful and compelling fireworks. Temporarily the sole lecturer trying to evangelize Syracuse, Douglas found no venue to welcome him for a meeting. So he held forth in a park, under a tree, before an audience of 5 people. Before the day ended, he had churned up a crowd of 500, and a congregational church offered him and his colleagues an old abandoned building, where they met for 3 more days of speeches. Collins, Kelly, and Raymond soon arrived to help create a full-fledged convention. But Collins, a recent convert to communitarianism, turned an entire morning gathering over to the question of abolishing private property. After listening to Collins's long speech against property and the abolitionists' alleged obsession with chattel slavery, Douglas stood and openly objected. A fierce row ensued, with many heated personal exchanges and eventually letters written back and forth with the AASS board headquarters in Boston. Douglas received a public reprimand for what he remembered as insubordination to my superiors. Douglas believed Collins had hijacked anti-slavery with an extraneous cause, especially, claimed the former slave, when he argued that property in the soil is worse than to enslave a man. The dispute spread so widely that both men wrote self-defensive letters to Maria Weston Chapman at the AASS board. Collins accused Kelly of instigating the entire affair because she was intolerant beyond degree and reported that Douglas had audibly groaned during the property speech, while Raymond called the very subject humbug and moonshine. Douglas defended his public objection. Collins had a perfect right to oppose property, said the black orator, but not by assisting the destruction of the slave's cause. This was ugly. Even Collins's wife got involved, snidely informing Chapman that Douglas and Raymond had engaged in a most ungenerous assault. This seemingly ludicrous dust-up was typical of others to follow on this and other tours. These earnest radicals, like those in virtually all such movements before and since, turned on each other, playing out jealousies, fatigue, ego wars, personality conflicts, and ideological differences. The AASS ignored Douglas's offer to resign as an agent. Tellingly, he added a quiet P.S. to his letter to Chapman. A message had arrived from Anna back home, asking for help to keep the household solvent. "I have none to send her," he informed Chapman. "Will you please see that she is provided with $25 or $30? In a simple line begging for money from his benefactors, with whom he was now at odds, we have a small window into Douglas's personal and professional travail at this early juncture in his career. He awoke every day worrying about how to feed his family, as well as how to best use his voice to free his fellow slaves. He struggled mightily in trying to do both. Despite these internecine battles, the crusade surged on to Rochester and Buffalo, where Douglas and Raymond would spend all of August 1843 achieving new successes and audiences. In a 4-day convention at Rochester, Douglas played the central role, advocating the pure Garrisonian resolution that the press and the living speaker were the only means by which to advance the cause of abolition. He later recalled how many Rochester-area abolitionists who had pledged support of the Liberty Party still allowed the troop access to churches and their own homes. The battle among anti-slavery organizations seemed all-consuming at the time, a struggle Douglas summed up thus: the beliefs that slavery was either a creature of law or a creature of public opinion. Reminiscing from the perspective of nearly 40 years, he reflected on how small the difference appears as I look back on it. Yet at the time of it, this difference was immense. Here, in 1843, Douglas likely already saw Rochester as a welcoming potential home. He again stayed with the Quakers, Amy and Isaac Post. Rochester made the young fugitive feel comfortable, and it made him sing. On August 5th, Douglas entertained a congregation with an abolition song before delivering his speech. At Buffalo, the only meeting space the lecturers could secure was, according to Douglas, an old, dilapidated, and deserted post office. Discouraged by the turnout of assorted street people and a mere handful of hackmen with whips in hand in such a bleak venue, Bradburn abandoned Douglas and went to Cleveland to visit relatives. For nearly a week, Douglas held forth alone in his forsaken dwelling, his audiences constantly increasing in numbers and respectability until a church opened its doors to an abolition meeting. The Baptist chapel soon proved too small, and Douglas moved on a Sunday into a park where, he claimed, a throng of 4,000 or 5,000 heard his slaveholder's sermon. Douglas played well in Buffalo and again made a mark with his courage and endurance. One extraordinary eyewitness account survives of Douglas's daily performances at the abandoned, windowless post office. A young woman, the daughter of Myron Holly, one of the founders of the Liberty Party in New York, attended every day with her little girl in tow. She had the happiness to hear Frederick Douglass make a speech, she remembered, at a poor little meeting, the odds and ends of the city, not a soul there I had ever seen. She had been so excited to hear a fugitive slave speak. He rose, and I soon perceived he was all alive. His soul poured out with rare pathos and power. Among other things, he told how a slaveholder would preach to an audience of slaves and take the text, "Servants, be obedient to your masters," and then proceed to say, "The Lord in his providence sent pious souls over to Africa, dark, heathen, benighted Africa, to bring you into this Christian land, where you can sit beneath the droppings of the sanctuary and hear about Jesus. The Lord has so established things that only through the channel of obedience can happiness flow." Douglas apparently completed this soliloquy with a story about a slave named Sam, who, given a task by his master, refused, dropped his hoe, and fell into a summer's nap on the ground. As the master discovered his bondman's disobedience, the slaveholder announced from Scripture, "He that knoweth his master's will and doeth it not shall be beaten with many stripes." Sam was whipped, and thus could happiness flow. With his use of these passages from Ephesians and Luke, Douglas pulled his audiences into his web of sarcasm and righteous indignation. Fortuitously for Douglas and Raymond. The convention's tour had arrived in Buffalo just before the scheduled gathering of the 1843 Colored Convention of National Black Leaders. Here, for the first time, Douglas joined as a delegate in this 13-year-old tradition. Of the 73 delegates, Douglas and Raymond were the only ones from Massachusetts among the 10 states represented. Most were from New York and members of the American and Foreign Anti-Slavery Society, as well as of the Liberty Party. The tone of the convention was certainly not Garrisonian. The opening address by Samuel Davis of Buffalo asserted African American citizenship and equal rights under the U.S. Constitution. Soon, the convention was embroiled in one of the most famous disputes in the history of antebellum black leadership, over what manner of resistance to tyranny black people should adopt. Henry Highland Garnet, born a slave on a plantation near Newmarket, Maryland, in 1815, only a little more than 2 years before Douglas, now a Presbyterian minister, superb orator, and leading black proponent of the Liberty Party, electrified the convention with an address to the slaves of the United States. Through a network of Quaker accomplices, Garnet had escaped slavery along with 10 other mostly family members at the age of 9, landing safely in New York City, where by 1826, his father saw that he was educated at the African Free School. By the time of the Buffalo Convention, Garnet had risen in black national leadership like few others, and broken with Garrison and moral suasion. He now advocated militant political action and potential revolutionary violence on the part of slaves. As the audience in Buffalo sat entranced, Garnet threw non-resistance out the window with a flourish. He invoked the memory of slave rebels Denmark Vesey, Joseph Chinquay, Madison Washington, and especially the patriotic Nathaniel Turner. He changed the tone and object of such convention gatherings, black or white, and demanded that they address the slaves themselves. In terms with which Douglas would have agreed at first, Garnet drew everyone into the streams of blood that marked slavery's history. Slavery had stretched its dark wings of death over the land. The church stood silently by. The priests prophesied falsely. And the people loved to have it so. He named the Declaration of Independence, the natural rights tradition, and Patrick Henry's famous demand for liberty or death. Garnet called slaves to their duty to use every means, both moral, intellectual, and physical, to attack their condition and their oppressors. Then came appeals to blood and retribution. Garnet urged African Americans to confront their masters and argued that they had far better all die immediately, than live slaves. How this message was actually to reach the slaves, Garnet never indicated. He chastised them for inaction, but he assured them, and presumably their instigators, that the fallen would have their names surrounded by a halo of glory. Let your motto be resistance, 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 he famously proclaimed. Douglas apparently squirmed and protested. An intense argument ensued as the convention debated the merits of Garnet's address. The author himself took nearly an hour and a half defending himself. Garnet did not want his words amended by an appointed committee and said blacks, slave or free, had waited long enough and that the time had come to take higher ground and other steps. As he finished, according to the minutes, the audience was literally infused with tears. In this swirl of emotions and high-flown rhetoric, Douglas, partly from fledgling Garrisonian principle, but also from an emerging pragmatic and situational view of violence, objected. Garnet had called for too much physical force, and Douglas preferred moral means a little longer. To advocate insurrection, Douglas held, would be irresponsible and result in disaster. Garnet rose to reply and urged slaves to tell their masters they wanted their liberty. If denied, we shall take it. Just who "we" meant was unclear. Just how this was to be done was even less clear. Douglas soon had the full rhetorical support of editors and managers back at the Liberator's offices in Boston. Two more times in the coming 2 days, Douglas spoke vehemently against issuing Garnett's address officially from the convention, and helped carry the vote against doing so, once by 19-18, and another time by 14-9. Douglas also voted against a resolution declaring the delegates' duty to vote the Liberty ticket, but lost that one decisively. This tangle between the two former Maryland slaves over the nature and use of violence would endure forever in the history of black leadership. It would not be the last time Douglas disagreed publicly with Garnett, but within half a decade, they would largely agree on the uses of violence. Having now missed several planned events on the 100 Conventions tour in Ohio, Douglas and Raymond hit the road again. They worked only a short time in Ohio, speaking at one large event held in a great shed built for this special purpose by abolitionists, Douglas remembered, with an estimated crowd of 1,000 in Clinton County, southeast of Dayton. Soon, they crossed into Indiana, an anti-abolition terrain the abolitionists had rarely encountered. In approximately a week and a half in central Indiana, Douglas and his companions, who now included Bradburn and William A. White, entered the belly of the northern pro-slavery beast. In 5 towns along their route, settled by migrants from the south, they met mobs nearly everywhere. Rotten eggs and stones and drunken hooligans were as usual in abundance, but at Pendleton, a short distance northeast of Indianapolis, an intoxicated gaggle of 30 or so men sought blood. Bradburn called them savage-looking loafers, making murderous threats. The lecturers had tried to hold their meetings in a Baptist church, but the mob confronted them outside. Gathering on the steps of the church in the evening of September 15th, Douglas, White, and Bradburn waded into the threatening band in what White called a conversational way. It worked on the first night, and they managed to make speeches about the rights of northern working men. But the following day, banned from the church grounds, the abolitionists, with their 130 local friends, set up a meeting with benches in the woods. Led by a man in a coonskin cap, the mob marched on the meeting and surrounded the gathering, and a few jumped on the speaker's platform and began smashing it to pieces. In the melee that followed, Douglas forgot all about non-resistance, grabbed a club, and waded into the crowd. He tried to give as he took and was beaten badly to the ground. His life may have been saved when White, seeing his comrade fleeing from hellhounds shouting, "Kill the nigger," like a fearfully true picture of the flight of the fugitive slave, threw himself on Douglas's assailant. According to Douglas's own remembrances, he was clubbed prostrate on the ground under a torrent of blows, my right hand broken and in a state of unconsciousness. White lost teeth and suffered gashes in his head. Douglas was taken in a wagon to the farm of Neil Hardy, a local Quaker, whose wife helped the young orator recover his equilibrium. Along with his wounded compatriots, he was back on a makeshift platform speaking the next day. Douglas had experienced much violence before, but never on the abolitionist platform. His right hand was not properly set, and, as he recalled many years later, never recovered its natural strength and dexterity. The violence in Indiana remained forever a pivotal experience for Douglas. Within a few years, he would date the end of his adherence to non-resistance to the Pendleton melee, and he would later tell William White how much he loved him for his bravery in defending him, and for how they, like two very brothers, were ready to dare, do, and even die for each other. One wonders how many times in his ensuing life as a writer, the man who had escaped Covey's clutches, Thomas Auld's whip, Hugh Auld's epithets, the bloody rumbles on the docks in Baltimore, and hundreds of besotted white men calling him nigger, would think of that old broken hand gripping the pen as he crafted some of the most magical phrases in American letters. The Pendleton mob may have put zeal in the pen held by the wounded hand. in Indiana, the nerves as well as the bodies of the traveling band of abolitionists all but disintegrated. A mere week after the Pendleton attacks,